From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Senate approves a stripped-down version of health care reform, a bipartisan bill sponsored by Senators Kassebaum and Kennedy.
To provide millions of Americans who are today forced to pass up jobs that would improve their standard of living or offer greater opportunities because they are afraid they'll lose their health insurance, a new sense of hope.
We'll talk with the insurance commissioner from the state of Washington who's dared to take on the insurance industry. Two giant telephone companies announced a multi-billion dollar merger this week. We'll find out what the mega merger means for labor and consumers and Black Latino coalitions. Some say it's a political strategy whose time has come. All this coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Radio's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Pennsylvania gave Bob Dole his 26th consecutive primary victory yesterday, but even before the votes were counted, the Republican Party chair said some frustrated GOP leaders are eager for Dole to take the offense heading into a fall showdown with President Clinton. Clinton was a runaway winner in the Democratic primary. Pennsylvania is viewed as a key battleground in November, but there, as well as nationally, most polls show Dole running far behind the president. The polls and several recent legislative setbacks have caused some jitters among Republicans over their nominee in waiting. On Monday, House Speaker Newt Gingrich went so far as to say the GOP is in a funk, and former Education Secretary William Bennett says there's little enthusiasm for Dole in the party. Meanwhile, Senator Dole is lining up some big names in law enforcement, not all of them Republicans, to back his assault on President Clinton's judicial appointments and record on crime. Dole's presidential campaign circulated testimonials yesterday from former Republican Attorneys General Dick Thornburgh, Edwin Meese, and William Barr. A fourth statement from Griffin Bell, who was a federal appeals judge himself before becoming Attorney General in the Carter administration, said Dole has hit the mark in a series of recent speeches critical of Clinton's judicial picks. It also put it's all part of a new Dole campaign drive to paint Clinton as soft on crime for appointing federal judges who exercise what he termed stealth liberalism from the bench. Dole also is calling for the American Bar Association, which he accuses of partisanship, to be yanked from the screening of judicial nominees. White House advisor George Stephanopoulos responded that sentences for violent crimes are 13 months longer under Clinton judges and prosecutors than during the last 2 years of the Bush administration. Responding to Dole's earlier salvos, the White House pointed out that Dole opposed only 3 of 185 Clinton nominees to reach Senate confirmation. And as we pointed out on Monday, Legal Times has reported that one of Dole's own judicial appointments has made similar rulings to New York Judge Harold Bear, who Dole has criticized harshly. We're not going to be talking about judges today. We're going to be talking about mega mergers in this first segment. Bell Atlantic and NYNEX have approved plans to merge into a single giant telecommunications company, the second largest telephone company behind AT&T. The region covered by the merger includes Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, New York, New England, and 4 other mid-Atlantic states. The area represents 37 million phone lines, one-third of the nation's long-distance traffic, and half of all internet users in the United States. Corporate chiefs are promising better service for customers and few, if any, job losses, but that's not what consumer activists and labor activists are saying. I'm joined by Juan Gonzalez in New York. Juan did a very interesting piece in the New York Daily News yesterday called Union Big Hears Bile Tone. And Juan, before you introduce our guest, who decides the headlines? Who writes these?
Oh, that's usually the copy editors who edit the copy and have to fill the actual space, Amy. So I never have anything to do with the headlines
well,
of my column.
I have to say it's a very creative one, and I've always envied that job of headline writer. You spend all day, just telling jokes to each other and coming up with the best lines?
Pretty much. You know, the most famous Daily News headline is the one that the news had when Ford refused to bail out New York City, Ford to City dropped dead. And of course, the other famous one was when the grave of Oswald was dug up again, and the Daily News had in the front page headline, Oswald still dead.
Well, moving from death to mega mergers, which may mean that in certain ways, why don't you introduce our guest?
Yes, well, we have from Boston, actually, where he's at a shareholders conference of one of the a meeting of one of the phone companies, is Jan Pierce, who is the vice president for the Communication Workers of America for Region 1, which covers all of the telephone workers in the CWA and other CWA members from New England throughout through New York and all of the Northeast. And I want to welcome Jan, and that he took time out of his schedule to be able to be with us today. Good morning, Jan.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
I remember one other
real good headline in the Daily News, and that was during the 1989 strike CWA and IBEW conducted against 9X, and Jack Newfield wrote an article about the strike, and the headline said, "The Ding-a-lings that run New York tell."
Okay, well, since we are talking about New York tell, I'd like to ask you, when you first officially heard about the merger and how the word got to you?
The first official word I received last Sunday. I was actually having lunch with my wife on the porch in our home on Long Island, and the former Speaker of the New York State Assembly, Stanley Fink, called and said that the chairman, I assumed was Ivan Seidenberg, chair of the 9X Corporation, would like to speak to me later in the day. So that was the first official announcement that I heard.
Now, what was Stanley Fink, as the former head of the New York State Assembly, doing calling you about a phone merger?
Mr. Fink is now a vice president of 9X, and I believe his particular duty is regulatory affairs. And frankly,
was that a step up for him or a step down?
Pay-wise, I would think that it's probably an enormous financial step upward, probably in the stratosphere. But at any rate, I think it was a pretty smart move from their standpoint. Stanley Fink and I go back a long time, and his message to me was, look, we know that you're not going to like this, but please think long range. Eventually, Ivan Seidenberg will head this merged company, and you know, you guys always get along well, and so don't mess this deal up. And frankly, I didn't like that because I like to think long term, but it's short term is what I'm really concerned with on this this merger.
And for those who haven't kept up with the merger, Seidenberg is the chairman of 9X, but Ray Smith, who is the chairman of Atlantic Bell, would initially be the chairman of the merged companies, with Seidenberg several years down the line replacing him. So that initially you're saying that Ray Smith from Atlantic Bell would be actually the head of this new phone company.
Yeah, that's correct. And we have not had a very good experience with Ray Smith. Indeed, we're just now concluding the bargaining cycle for this year, where we've gone through from AT&T all the baby bells, and the last baby bell to come in was Bell Atlantic. It took us 5.5 months and $10 million in a corporate campaign to bring Bell Atlantic in line with the rest of the industry. So he has not shown himself to be sensitive to workers' needs.
Well, let me ask you this. What does this merger mean both for workers, your union members, and for the general public? Because the companies are claiming that only about 2,000 to 3,000 people, mostly management people, will be laid off as a result of this merger. Do you believe that?
Well, no, I do not believe that. But also, you know, they made a public relations decision on how to roll this deal out. And as a result, if you look at today's financial newspapers, especially the New York Times and Wall Street, the investment community is not too happy because they didn't say that they were going to have deep cuts. Now, I say that was a public relations decision because they saw what happened when Bob Allen, chair and CEO of AT&T, lavished himself with exorbitant compensation increases, announced the another breakup of AT&T, and at the same time said he was going to pay for all of this with by laying 40,000 more workers off at AT&T. That caused a huge backlash out there in the general public and in the investment community. And so they chose not to tell the truth about the long-term plans of Bell Atlantic and NYNEX. They chose, rather, just to throw a bone to Wall Street by saying there will only initially be 3,000 jobs lost. And then they further tried to pacify the unions by saying that will all be management. Well, I have a couple points on that. One is it's about time the union movement stepped up to the plate and represented all workers, union, non-union, and in some cases, and especially in this case, in the case of AT&T, even the management workers. It's crystal clear that if they can merge the operations of management and reduce the workforce by 3,000, it's clear what's happening, what will happen down the road when they start merging craft jobs. It's going to devastate the workforce here and across the country, because this is just the second of the big mergers.
Well, in terms of what the economics say, I mean, clearly both companies have their own billing processes. Where do you see the most likely movement in terms of them laying off unionized workers?
Yeah, well, initially it will be in those functions that you just characterized as billing. Billing, for some large corporations now, billing is being done in Asia. But billing will obviously be controlled by out of one center. I wouldn't be surprised if it's located in some right-to-work state in the Belt Atlantic region. The commercial marketing and operator services functions, all highly technical, can be performed from any location. I always, to make it simple to understand, if one calls for Juan Gonzalez's telephone number from Washington, D.C., and they call area code 212-555-1212, that's probably answered in Elmira, New York.
Upstate New York.
Pardon?
Upstate New York.
Upstate New York. So, but it could just as easily be answered in Denver, Colorado, because all they do is look at a screen now. Mm-hmm. And so those are the real initial pressures are going to be on those job functions. And there will be unrelenting pressure to downsize. I mean, that's really what Wall Street is after, and they march to that tune.
We're talking to John Pierce. He's Vice President of the Communication Workers of America, and we're talking about the Bell Atlantic NYNEX merger. Now, I wanted to ask you, doesn't this go against the whole 1984 divestiture, the whole idea of breaking up the monopoly?
Yeah, not only that, it in my judgment, it violates the spirit and intent of the most recent law enacted by Congress, signed only last month into law by President Clinton. It's called the Telecommunications Reform Act of 1996. The promise of that act, which was written by the industry officials themselves, and I challenge anybody to say in any elected position in Washington, D.C., that they read that bill and understood it. They didn't and don't, because they didn't write it, and the industry did. It was supposed to mean more competition. Bell Atlantic was supposed to come up and open up shop in 9X territory and compete for core services and new glamorous services. 9X was supposed to go into Bell Atlantic. But what really happened was, the first thing out of the box, Southwestern Bell merged with Pacific Telesis. And secondly, 9X and Bell Atlantic just got together. So instead of four companies operating within each other's territory, you have two now. And you have less competition.
There's expected to be soon another merger in the Midwest, isn't there, between some of the baby bells there?
No question about it. Ameritech and U.S. West will probably be together before the before the end of May. I would predict Bell South will look at something a little bit more unique, maybe partnering with MCI or Sprint, or even AT&T. So the end result is as you just said, Dan, and that is that the breakup by the Department of Justice back in 1984 was to break up to release the stranglehold that AT&T had on local and long distance service. And now we're seeing just the opposite. The breakups are now becoming mergers. And one thing is clear: whether we're talking mergers or breakups, service goes down the drain, and workers take it on the chin. It's about
Jan, let me talk about service for a second. I mean, I know myself, calling information now, trying to get a new phone installed. Any one of those services now from the phone companies are a horror in terms of the amount of time you got to wait. You call information in some places now, and you've got computers basically dealing with you. Why is the service continuing to decline at the same time that the technology seems to get better?
Technology is improving, but you still need the skilled hands of workers. And what you're experiencing is what we're going to experience even more now, and that is there aren't enough workers to get the job done. What you're experiencing, if I challenge any, especially in where you live, Juan. Now, this may not be true in some other areas. The service is just a little bit better, but let me just make a point with that comment, Juan. We are going to fight this merger. I believe we have an excellent opportunity to defeat it. Why? Because there's three arenas this battle is going to be waged in. One is the regulatory arena, second is the political arena, and then third is the arena of public opinion. Service is deteriorating across this country, especially in baby bells. We will be able to go to the utility commissions and, with anecdotal information as well as facts and figures, show them what has happened. It won't be difficult to do it in the state of New York because the Public Service Commission in New York just fined the New York tail portion of NYNEX $50 million for not being able to meet minimal service levels, the largest fine they can possibly impose. We can tell that story pretty much across the Beltlandic NYNEX footprint. And if just the downsizing pressures from technology has caused service to deteriorate, think of what happens when Wall Street sticks its nose into the business. There's going to be even more pressure to downsize. Secondly, it's a good time to talk to politicians and enroll them and enlist them in this battle against this merger, because they're feeling heat from the third arena, and that's the arena of public opinion. Americans are simply tired of picking up the paper and reading where these CEOs give themselves these exorbitant, scandalous wage and bonus packages and stock options, and then pay for it by shoving workers out the door.
Jen, I wanted to just take this issue to presidential politics for a minute. I mean, you have the Telecommunications Act, one of the most historic changes in the telecommunications industry in 50 years. You've got the passage of NAFTA, also historic legislation. All this is being passed under President Clinton. Is being passed with a great deal of resistance from labor, but labor is losing here. Where is labor's voice in this election, and do you see that Dole will take any kind of a different stance than Bill Clinton has taken?
Well, I think in every one of those bills that you just talked about, Dole and Clinton were in lockstep. So on that scorecard, we have nothing to gain by going to Bob Dole. I think, frankly, from my standpoint, and I know this is not, I'm not speaking on behalf of organized labor here, but I know I'm speaking on behalf of a lot of progressive labor leaders. We haven't been tough enough on Bill Clinton.
In fact, CWA is part of the AFL, which has endorsed Clinton, given the earliest endorsement ever.
He got off easy. But I think there's something more at stake here. I think the presidential politics are pretty much inconsequential. We need to rid this country of the likes of Newt Gingrich. The one thing that we can be sure of, if the president runs well, which he seems to be right now, we ought to be able to pick up enough seats to regain control of Congress, and that will be a major step.
Jan Pierce, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Jan Pierce, Vice President of the Communications Workers of America. You're in the midst of an election yourself in your own union. And Juan, thank you very much for joining us from New York. Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News. And if you can, get his piece that he wrote yesterday, Union Big Hears Bile Tone. It's about Jan Pierce, and it's about the 9X Atlantic merger. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we speak with the Insurance Commissioner of Washington State about the Kassebaum Kennedy bill and about taking on the insurance industry. After that, we'll talk about black-brown coalitions. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Senate yesterday unanimously passed a basic health reform measure that will make it easier for Americans to get and keep health insurance if they change jobs or have a pre-existing condition. It's called the Kassebaum Kennedy Bill. Yesterday, Kansas Senator Nancy Kassebaum talked about it.
This bill certainly wouldn't go as far as Senator Kennedy would like for it to. But he was realistic about the possibilities of what we could achieve with a more limited bill. I believe, Mr. President, that whether it helps 25 million people, as has been estimated by GAO, or whether it only helps 10 million people, or if it helps 50 million people, the important part of it is it does provide some peace of mind for those who desperately want to have some assurance that if they lose their job or change their job, if they have had insurance that had covered a pre-existing condition, they won't be excluded from that coverage. It would be my hope, Mr. President, that out of this bipartisan effort, we can go to conference and we can come through conference with the bill, which will be acceptable to everyone. Because what we can accomplish with this more limited legislation will be of value. And far better to have that than to try for too much and fail again. Other aspects that have been added as amendments in both the House and the Senate may have some value, and some have extremely important value, but need to be debated, I would suggest, on their own merits at another time. And I think the great danger is that if we add too much to this, then it will fail.
And that's Senator Nancy Kassebaum of Kansas. The Kassebaum-Kennedy bill now goes to conference committee, where it must be ironed out with a House measure that includes medical savings accounts and malpractice reform opposed by the White House. Now, one of the amendments that did get on the Kassebaum-Kennedy bill was the amendment around mental health. The health insurance bill will make an immense change in national health policy by requiring insurers to provide coverage for mental illnesses that's equivalent to the coverage provided for other conditions like heart disease, diabetes, and cancer. And it was a very unusual evening, I think it was last Thursday evening, when Senator Domenici's amendment was considered by the Senate. Very few amendments got tagged onto this bill. Because senators got up, Senator Domenici, who himself has suffered from mental health problems over the years, Senator Simpson got up, Senator Dorgan, and Senator Wellstone got up, and they talked from their own personal experience about why mental health should be considered on a parity with health. And this is what Senator Paul Wellstone had to say.
Mr. President and colleagues, there are several arguments for requiring parity for mental health services. First, we now have cost-effective treatments for mental illnesses, and high rates of success are being achieved across the spectrum of diagnoses. For example, 80% of individuals with depression respond to treatment. Second of all, mental illness often results in physical illness, inability to work, impaired relationships, and sometimes crime and homelessness. Wouldn't it be better to end the discrimination and have less of the homelessness? Wouldn't it be better to end the discrimination and enable people to work and be productive citizens? And finally, Mr. President, mental health services are already part of the health delivery in the United States. It is only old data and old ideas that keep us from covering mental health the same way we cover any other real illness, whether it is acute or chronic. Mr. President, I don't usually do this on the floor of the Senate, but I would like to dedicate my remarks to my brother, who has struggled with mental illness almost his whole life. I yield the floor.
And that is Senator Paul Wellstone of Minnesota talking among a number of senators who spoke about their own personal experiences and why mental health is a critical part of any health care bill. Well, we're going to talk about mental health in a little while, but we want to talk overall about the Kassebaum-Kennedy bill and also about a crusading insurance commissioner who has taken on the industry in a way that Congress has not dared to do. We're joined now by Washington State Insurance Commissioner Deborah Senn, and thank you very much for being with us on Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, why don't you tell us about what you've been doing in Washington State? In fact, don't you have a kind of Kassebaum-Kennedy bill already in place in Washington?
Absolutely. These are reforms that have been in place for about 2 years now in the state of Washington. We have portability, so people can change jobs and move from geographic location to geographic location. We have limits on pre-existing condition, which is more far-reaching than the Kennedy-Kassebaum bill, and it's been very, very popular with the public.
Now, how did you manage to do this? I should let listeners know that you, as an insurance commissioner, have been elected, and you're a rare one in that. I guess something like 12 insurance commissioners have been elected around the country. Otherwise, they're appointed.
That's correct.
So they usually represent a more corporate point of view. What were the planks that you ran on when you first went after the insurance industry and went for the insurance commissioner job?
Well, actually, it was in 1992 that I ran for election, and obviously the issue was health care reform. And people probably aren't aware that the insurance commissioners regulate the health insurance industry generally in most states. And so I ran on the platform of better access to affordable health insurance, and pre-existing condition and portability were the issues which I actually raised in my campaign and are the first areas that we worked on after I was elected.
But how do you take on the insurance industry, and how has the insurance industry taken on you? I mean, you clearly are insurance industry enemy number one. How did you first go after them?
Well, basically in 1993, after the election, the legislature in the state of Washington passed health care reform, national health care reform. And under the act, health care reform in the state of Washington. And under the act that was passed by the legislature, I was authorized to do insurance reforms to increase access for people. And so initially we worked with the industry. The industry gave verbal support at the time to healthcare reform, and we put these reforms in place so that people could change jobs without being dropped by their insurance coverage, and they could access health insurance without being excluded because they were sick or had a pre-existing condition. And we put these reforms into place in 1994, and actually the industry stood up and supported the reforms initially. They were encouraging, they said, we can do this, although they felt that the reforms were pretty far-reaching, and there was some concern by them. However, with the change in the political makeup nationwide in 1994, and also a huge change here in the state of Washington, the industry changed its position, and then they moved to repeal most of health care reform that passed in the state. And they, in fact, got the legislature, it was a new legislature, to repeal so much of it that they have, we believe, created a problem in the marketplace once again. And so we have half of health care reform, and then the rest of it got repealed.
What are you left with?
Well, basically what we're left with are the insurance reforms, and in effect, they were originally rules that were adopted by my office, but in 1995, they were so popular, the new legislature, which was anti-health care reform, put them into law because the public was so pleased with the fact that they finally could access health insurance without being locked out because they'd been sick. But then what the legislature did is they repealed the second part of it, which was supposed to support the insurance reforms to make sure that rates would be stable. So the big issue that I have with the industry right now is the fact that they've come in and they've asked for large rate increases because of the repeal of the legislature, and I have said no, and so we're in litigation over that.
Let me ask about the issue of the cost of health insurance, because okay. Something that's not being talked about as much in the Kassebaum-Kennedy bill is while there's portability, if you leave one job and go to another, you can take your health insurance with you. They weren't willing to put into this caps, so while you may be allowed to take it with you, the price of it could go up three times. What happens in Washington State?
Well, I don't think that there's any support for this idea that the price of it could go up three times. The industry is saying that. I know that the Health Insurance Association of America are saying, you know, that it will go up three times or 30%. But, you know, the National Actuarial Association has rebutted what the Health Insurance Association of America has said. Certainly, if you allow people to access the system who are going to make claims, you will have an impact. However, in the state of Washington, we had planned to spread the cost evenly across the largest pool possible. And portability, remember, is people who are already in the system. And so you should not see that dramatic an impact with portability. It's a question of changing jobs, and then you're still paying premiums, and if your new job has health insurance, then you basically move into their insurance program. And so I've never really seen any studies which suggest that portability will have such an impact. The issue of pre-existing condition, bringing people into the system, usually is the one that raises the question of what the cost impact will be. However, let me just make this point very quickly. The Kassebaum-Kennedy bill is a modest step, and the way it is designed, I do not see that it's going to bring huge numbers of people into the system. Certainly it will be a relief for people in this country, but not so many that there's going to be a big cost impact.
And we're talking to Commissioner Deborah Senn. She's the elected insurance commissioner of Washington State, a consumer activist who's been giving the blues the blues. Yes, you've been going after Blue Cross of Washington. I was looking at a local newspaper article about you and how the Blue Cross of Washington and Alaska fought against the public disclosure of their top executives' salaries. What does that have to do with you? Is this what you demanded?
Oh, well, obviously the issue of corporate salaries and the disparity between corporate salaries and those of line workers is a big issue in this country. Well, interestingly, in the state of Washington, Blue Cross and other Blues plans, and we have a number of them, as they're called, in this state, have CEO salaries which are probably some of the highest in the country. For example, the CEO of Blue Cross of Washington And let me just add and make this point, Amy, that these are not-for-profit plans. Blue Cross plans are generally not-for-profit. So in the state of Washington, the Blue Cross CEO made already about $480,000 last year, asked our office for a 19% rate increase, which we're in litigation over, and then raised the salary during the course of that time in the last year from $484,000 to $752,000 a year. And this is for a not-for-profit CEO. And frankly, I think it's a disgrace. And you know, this is a company that's supposed to be making sure that they're community-minded, that people have access to health insurance, and yet they're asking their consumers and their subscribers to tighten their belts while the CEOs and officers of the company, or I'm sorry, the executives of the company, live off of, you know, the fat of the land.
So what can you do about that as insurance commissioner?
Well, I have no direct authority to control the salaries, but first of all, we make sure that they're released and well-known, because a little sunshine always goes a long way. That's number one. Second of all, to the extent that it's an issue in rates, obviously we can raise it. Interestingly, we found that the Tacoma-based Blue Cross plan, which is called Pierce County Medical, if they were to take the top 10 salaries of their executives and reduce them to about $75,000 a year, they would save $1 million of a $7 million rate increase. So this has an impact on the bottom line, and we think that it is unwise and unfair to consumers to be paying CEOs of not-for-profit so much money when people who are sick and in need of coverage cannot afford health care.
Now, Commissioner Sen, clearly the insurance industry does not want Washington State to be setting an example for the country. Now, they've gone so far as to threaten to pull out of Washington. Is that true, and what can you do about that?
Well, that is a myth, really, that's being perpetrated by the insurance industry. There is talk, and the legislator who sits on the health care committee in the House, who's opposed to health care reform, who's an insurance agent himself, has gone around saying that why, you know, some 22 companies are leaving the state. This is absolutely not true. We certainly have some issues in the individual market because the insurers have to cover people. They cannot exclude them anymore because they're sick, and they don't want to do it. And they are trying to come up with ways to avoid covering people, and we're having to do some enforcement. But the market here is healthy. We have an individual market, and the big insurers who are in this state covering people continue to cover people.
There was an interesting piece about you in the Wall Street Journal, but in every part of the headline, there were like four little headlines, there was a warning, sort of setting an example, saying to others, this could be a problem if you're an elected official. It starts by saying perils of pioneering. Mm-hmm. Then it says health care reform in state of Washington riles nearly everyone, and then has a quote from you, we made some mistakes.
Excuse me, the quote was not from me. The quote was from an insurance company executive on the second page of the article.
Oh, sorry, it looked like it was from me.
Right, and it was obviously made to look like it was from me, but it was not from me.
Have they printed any response from you?
We have sent a response to them because we feel that the article was misleading in a number of ways. It had some statements that we basically told the reporter were absolutely not correct. And so we have sent a letter or an op-ed piece to the Wall Street Journal, but I'm not aware at this point if they've published it.
Let me ask you something. What do you think of single payer?
Well, first of all, it's obviously, you know, the big single payer advocate in this country is Congressman Jim McDermott, who's from the state of Washington. And single payer is obviously very controversial, and it's not something that is politically acceptable at this point in this country. And so really the debate about single payer really is not on the really up on the radar screen in a major way at this point. I'm hoping in the state of Washington we had an employer-mandated bill that was what was repealed. It allowed for universal coverage and in a competitive marketplace. And so that is a good idea, and even that we can't get passed. So we are a long way from either an employer mandate or a single payer. But whenever I speak about health care reform, I say, let's not give up. And I quote Winston Churchill, his famous quote, which he didn't know he was talking about health care reform, when he said, "Americans always do the right thing after they tried everything else." So we're in the tried everything else stage, and I think we should just keep working toward universal coverage no matter what the form.
Do you think it would be easier under Clinton or under Dole?
Well, I'm a big supporter of President Clinton, and I believe that what happened yesterday in the Senate with a 100-0 vote shows that the issue of health care reform has not gone away. And clearly, Senator Dole, with his attempted amendment of medical savings account, which basically would help the healthy and the rich, shows that you don't want to put health care reform into the hands of Senator Dole. So I think that with the passage of this bill, we're back on the road to health care reform. It obviously will not be as comprehensive and quick as the idea in 1992, but we're certainly on the road and we can continue to make progress.
Well, Commissioner Senn, we're going to talk more about health care on Monday. We'll be joined by David Broder and Haynes Johnson, as well as a consumer activist, talking about what happened to health care in this country and the health care legislation in Congress. We want to thank Insurance Commissioner Deborah Senn of Washington State for joining us this morning.
Thank you. You're
listening to Democracy Now! Up next, a discussion of black-brown coalitions. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington, and I'm joined by my co-host Salim Wakil in Chicago, senior editor of In These Times and columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome, Salim.
Good morning, Amy.
It's nice to have you with us. You know, I was just looking over, talking to some people in California yesterday, learning about this weekend's fourth anniversary gang truce march and rally that's taking place, which is bringing together African Americans, Chicanos, men, women, young people for a rally that's going to take place on Saturday, starting at a public housing project in Watts. And this issue of black-brown coalitions is one that is very much taking hold around the country. I mean, we saw it after the immigrant beating in Riverside with the sheriff's deputies beating the immigrants. And we're hearing about things that are happening in Illinois as well, your home state.
Yes, we are. And perhaps one of the more prominent advocates of this kind of coalition is State Senator Jesus Garcia. Or Chuy Garcia, as he's more popularly known, out of Chicago's first district. And he's been pushing this issue for quite a while. He's the first Mexican-American ever elected to the Illinois Senate. He was elected in 92, former ally of the late Harold Washington, Chicago's first black mayor. And he's perhaps one of the state's most articulate progressives. He's also the chair of the Illinois Minority Caucus and perhaps the most insistent proponent of coalition politics in the state. Chuy?
Good morning,
Senator Garcia.
Good morning, Amy.
Nice to have you with us.
It's a pleasure.
I'm glad you could join us. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts on the signs that blacks and Latinos finally are beginning to coalesce in ways that seem logical, and how you are pushing that issue in Illinois.
Well, I think that we've had some good examples in history
in at least a couple of major cities throughout the country where the empowerment of African Americans and Latinos has for the first time given the new majorities in those cities, predominantly African American and Latino, an opportunity to make history by electing, for example, in 1983, Chicago's the first African American mayor and reform mayor in Chicago for a long, long time when Harold Washington was elected. And during his term between 1983 and 1987, it was actually a period of a term and just the beginning of the second, we saw some unprecedented things in Chicago. We saw minorities ascending to important decision-making positions in city government. We saw the African-American community become a real important political and electoral player in the region, and we saw the rise and the Latino community thrust into political prominence at that time, and it's a community that remains courted very heavily by elected officials who want to run from anything like the city council to governor of the state of Illinois. In New York, I think the coalition expressed itself and its potential when it elected David Dinkins, the first mayor of the city of New York. And I think these are some of the possibilities that can take place. Unfortunately, I think the experience in Chicago and perhaps in other cities has been that we've been too focused on building these alliances and coalitions at election time and around electoral issues. And I think that if we're really going to make an impact and make progress that is long-lasting, it's got to be done at the grassroots level. It has to be people to people. The reason I say that is because politicians come and go. Politicians make deals, and unless the relationship is cemented by a real understanding, a real appreciation, real tolerance and cementing that takes place between people, one school to another school, churches, community-based organizations in one community toward another, etc., these coalitions and these alliances won't last. And they need to last because at the present time, minorities and women are under attack by policies at the national level, in various state legislatures that want to do away with some programs and benefits which were hard-earned, doing away with affirmative action in employment and education, doing away with those things that have opened up doors for minorities. Therefore, the importance and the practicality of building these types of alliances, particularly in areas where we have become the new majorities, places like New York and Chicago and certainly L.A., but more importantly, because we share a common interest in protecting many of the federal and state laws which have enabled us to begin opening doors and to make advances in society.
Well, Senator Garcia, do you think that the gang truce march and those kinds of similar efforts, which are also on the way in Chicago, for example, on that particular level, are those the kinds of grassroots focus movements you think are appropriate?
I think that
or useful.
I think, Salim, that they have potential. However, if we're going to build relationships, I think that the onus and a great responsibility has to be accepted and taken on by the institutions that are most important in communities. And in the Latino community, I would say that the church and the Catholic Church in the Mexican-American community, for example, can be a very, very important institution that has authority, that can help people come together, that can promote and perpetuate
the concept of tolerance, the concept of sharing. And I think that those institutions are probably best equipped to embark on a long-term, day-to-day building of relationships among communities. I think that the gang truce has potential, but is more volatile. It is more volatile because the actors in the gang phenomenon and dynamic tend to have a less stable basis from which to operate. They, as a result of the day-to-day activity and dynamics of gangs and the link oftentimes to drug trafficking and to violence and some of the more spontaneous activity that is often affiliated with the street type of activity, makes it, I think, less reliable in the long term. However, it is important because members, individuals who have been in gangs who are trying to make peace a reality also have an ability to put the message out through a network of real people and real actors in the community. And this is one component of the community that also has to be pulling along and carrying its share of the responsibility, especially when you're dealing with many individuals who, for many reasons, are in a relatively unstable situation where they've been caught up in the cycle of violence and drug trafficking.
A cycle that's very similar to the cycle in the African-American community.
And increasingly so.
Increasingly so. But in Chicago, for example, the example you mentioned, after Harold Washington's death, the coalitions that had been cultivated during his tenure seemed to disintegrate. And now it seems that the Latino community is much more closely aligned to Mayor Daley and his forces than to the independent forces of the black community. How do you assess that development?
That's exactly what occurred. After the death of Harold Washington, we saw the fracturing of the coalition, first of all with the largest partner of that alliance, the African-American community. We saw a splintering of the pro-Washington forces around who to support, who would be the heir apparent to Mayor Washington in a special election that was to be held more than a year after his death. And when the largest partner became fractured and divided, I think the Latino community felt that it had to play the field, so to speak, and some of the elected officials in that community quickly gravitated toward other options given the instability that appeared to be emerging within the former progressive coalition. And that is why I think it is so important not to rely on politicians or elected officials solely or primarily for building coalitions. I think that as officials, we can play an important role. However, politicians will do what politicians do, and the relationship is too important for society, for the communities involved, to be left up to simply or primarily politicians. The institutions that carry weight and that do work on a day-to-day basis, such as churches and schools and parks, etc., community-based organizations from black clubs to larger community and neighborhood-based organizations can have a much far-reaching and longer-lasting effect. And that's why in Chicago, for example, in the community that I represent, which borders on the traditional African-American community, we have set ourselves about building a better relationship people to people. And this is occurring at a local high school where there's been a long history of racial tensions.
Is that Farragut?
Farragut Career Academy, where as a result of the work of the Lawndale Coalition and the local school council, the school has I think, turned a corner with respect to the tensions that existed there for so long that you would read about in newspaper accounts and in the news that a riot was about to break out, that there was increasing violence and incidents almost on a daily basis. For the past 2 years, the school has been, on the contrary, projecting itself very positively. There's been a really important change in the administration of the school, and it is no longer in the news for these types of problems. We have taken an area, a corridor, the community, where the African Americans and Latinos converge and make contact with each other on a daily basis, and it includes parks, it includes schools, it includes the rapid transit and the bus stops when people go to work, because this is where people tend to make their opinions and form their opinions about each other and where incidents occur. For example, we've had in several of the subway or L stops in Chicago where there's a pattern where people get mugged or are robbed or are stuck up at gunpoint. And for the most part, this has been a dynamic where African Americans target Latinos for these crimes. That Latinos don't come to the conclusion that this is the only type of crime that exists and that it's always black on brown, that the majority of crime in the African-American community is black on black crime, that therefore the generalization shouldn't be there. On the other hand, it has been at meetings in schools, at the parishes and churches, and at the parks, where people are beginning to see each other a bit differently and become more sensitive to the problems that both groups deal with on a day-to-day basis.
State Senator Jesus Garcia, let me ask you, as you are doing organizing at a grassroots level, has the National Democratic Party approached you to start reaching out into the community?
The Democratic Party at the state level, I think, has taken note of our ability to maintain a good relationship in Latino and African-American areas. I think that in our part of the city where the communities meet, and to the north of the African-American community, you have another Latino community that is largely Puerto Rican, and on the south side is largely Mexican-American. And beyond that, on both sides of town, you have white communities on the northwest and the southwest sides. People have taken notice that something is going on there that doesn't fit the mold or the tradition or the history of segregation and intolerance in Chicago, that where Latinos and African Americans meet, you don't have panic peddling as far as real estate, shady real estate practices and unethical real estate practices are going on, where people aren't running away from each other, and that people can adapt to each other. People can learn to live side by side. And probably most importantly thus far, that people can agree on political agendas. And if you begin to agree on political agendas, there's probably a clear indication that you can agree on other things in society, such as dealing with the day-to-day problems that people confront in terms of poor education and bad schools and the need to fix up those schools, on the fact that people are concerned about crime, that people want to protect their senior citizens, and that mothers and fathers find it increasingly difficult to raise their children. And these are issues that transcend racial lines and barriers.
Senator Jesus Garcia, we're going to have to wrap up now. I want to thank you very much for joining us. The state senator is a Mexican-American legislator from Chicago and a board member of the National Association of Latino Elected Officials. And as you can hear, a leader in building Black-Latino coalitions. And Salim, thank you very much for joining us from Chicago.
Thank you, Amy.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason, help from Errol Maitland at WBI in New York. We'd also like to thank John Ford and Greg at Chaos in Olympia, Washington, and Frank Stoltz and John Martinez at KPFK in Los Angeles. If you'd like a copy of the show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Tune in tomorrow for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll